This is the Environment Show. It's about our stewardship of the Earth and the beauty and mystery of life in all its forms. I'm Peter Burley. Coming up, War and the Environment, the second of a series. U.S. military commanders say that environmental laws affect the way they conduct operations. Human needs cannot be met in the next century unless we change the way we think and do business. Lester Brown from World Watch comments on the state of the world and why we should lease a carpet instead of buying one. The end of the Cold War endangers brown bears in the Russian Far East. And on the Earth calendar, red and pink grapefruit are being picked in Florida. It's part of the Great American Harvest. These stories and more coming up on The Environment Show. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. In our first segment on the environmental consequences of war, we looked at developments in international law which prohibit the use of the environment as a method of warfare. A tribunal set up to collect money for environmental damage caused by Iraq and the Gulf War, and an evolving doctrine of environmental war crimes. Now, we examine what impact environmental considerations have on the conduct of U.S. military operations. Captain John Quinn of the Navy, who is Deputy Assistant Judge Advocate General for International and Operational Law in the Pentagon, says environmental considerations play a major role in American military planning. U.S. requirements govern domestic operations, and some U.S. environmental laws follow Navy vessels when they sail over the horizon.
The Marine Mammal Protection Act, the Endangered Species Act, for example. So we take those obligations seriously, and we're getting better and better at ensuring that those requirements are understood.
Citing legal obligations to minimize collateral and environmental damage in military operations, Navy Captain Michael Lohr, who is legal counsel to the Joint Chiefs of Staff, or counsel to General Shelton, says that environmental considerations have been a factor in target selection in recent bombing attacks on Iraq.
Where there were targets that we suspected or where we thought there might be some sort of environmental consequence from the strike, we took, first off, we knew that. That was identified early on as a consideration that this or that target might have environmental consequences that would be disproportionate to the military advantage. And that target was either removed from the list or, in one instance, an objective was picked within the target that severely limited the type of environmental damage that might result from the strike.
Laura cites an example of how this is done.
If you're going after an oil refinery, let's take that as a hypothetical example. There are lots of things that you can strike to take an oil refinery out of the ability to manufacture, to refine oil. Some of those, for instance, if you're hitting the distilling towers or the storage tanks themselves, can have significant environmental damage, just in terms of the spillage, the fires that might result, that sort of thing. There are other things that can be targeted within that refinery complex that have little or no environmental consequences, but will effectively render that plant incapable of refining oil. And those are the decisions that targeteers make, operators make, and ultimately the national command authorities make when they decide on which targets are appropriate and how to strike those targets.
Hayes Parks, Special Assistant for Law of War for the Judge Advocate General of the Army, recalls an operation where a bomb attack was called off entirely to avoid an oil spill in the Persian Gulf.
There was an operation in 1988 where U.S. forces went in to attack some Iranian gas-oil separation platforms in the Persian Gulf. They were being used as early warning and supply points by the Iranian forces that were attacking our forces and the tankers that were in the Persian Gulf. The decision was taken by the Secretary of Defense to send in Marine Corps reconnaissance personnel and Navy SEALs to actually conduct an assault on those platforms rather than use airstrikes, because it would minimize the risk of the oil leaking from the platforms.
While military doctrines that minimize environmental effects of warfare are having an impact, Navy Captain Quinn says domestic environmental law is defining how the Navy trains and executes its missions.
It's certainly true to say that U.S. environmental law affects the way the Navy operates. As you're well aware, a number of statutes, not just Endangered Species Act, Marine Mammal Protection Act, but also the Act to Prevent Pollution from Ships, the Ocean Dumping Act, have extraterritorial effect, and therefore the United States Navy, wherever we may operate, needs to be concerned with and comply with those laws. But I think even more important than that, as we strive to have the Navy operate in a way that not only complies with environmental law, but also complies with our own sense of environmental stewardship, that has an effect on the way people get used to doing things at sea. There's an old adage that you train like you fight, and you fight like you train. A Navy that trains off the U.S. coast and elsewhere in such a way to be environmentally responsible will tend more to fight in an environmentally responsible way.
Quinn also says that part of the Navy's environmental ethic is driven by the attitudes of the younger officers and sailors in the ranks.
The Navy is populated by people. The average age is in the low 20s, who have grown up in the late 70s, 80s, and so forth, when the environmental ethic and understanding of this country was growing. Those people are now the junior officers standing watch on the ship. They're now the enlisted people with the binoculars on the ship. And so it's fair to say that the Navy desires to do this, to do the environmentally correct and protective thing, simply for policy reasons as well as for requirement to comply with the law.
While few of us think that environmental considerations play a role in war, both domestic and international environmental law are shaping both military campaigns and the attitudes of the soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines that fight them. I'm Peter Burley. At the close of this millennium, Lester Brown, president of the World Watch Institute, a nonprofit environmental think tank in Washington, D.C., finds that the growth and changes that have taken place in the 20th century cannot continue in the 21st. His State of the World 1999 volume, which has just been published, inspires both hope and despair about the future.
We've seen the output of goods and services worldwide increase 17-fold since 1900. We've seen population increase fourfold since 1900. These trends obviously are not going to continue. I think our principal conclusion was that just as the 20th century was quite different from the 19th century, so the 21st century will not be a simple extension of the 20th century. And the question, of course, is what will it be like?
Brown says that existing economic models are not adequate to provide for human needs in the future.
What we have evolved over this past century is a fossil fuel-based, automobile-centered, throwaway economy. This is an economy that sort of reached its zenith in the United States. But as we look at efforts in China to start adopting this economy, for example, we see it's not going to work. The Chinese can never use materials at the rate we do. They cannot have a car in every garage. If they do and they use oil at the American rate, they'll need more oil than the world either currently produces or is ever likely to produce. So as we look at China, we can begin to see that the Western model is not going to work. And so we're looking at a future now that's based not on fossil fuels, but on renewable energy, one that will have a solar, broadly defined, / hydrogen economy. We're looking at a transportation system that will be centered not around the automobile, but around, in urban settings, at least around rail and the bicycle. And we're looking not at a throwaway economy, but at a comprehensive reuse, recycle economy.
Brown says we've been using raw materials at a faster rate than they can be replenished, but he thinks the trend is already changing. For example, now 56% of the steel produced in the United States comes from recycled scrap, and some businesses are selling services instead of simply throwaway products.
In Atlanta, Georgia, Ray Anderson, who's the CEO at a company called Interface that produces carpets in, I don't know, a dozen countries around the world and markets in more than 100. But Ray Anderson has come up with an entirely new concept of carpeting. Instead of selling carpets to companies, for example, you contract with them to provide carpeting services. And so you provide the carpeting, you maintain it, you replace it as needed, and maintain the whatever quality of carpeting the client would like. But then when the carpeting is worn out and you take it out and replace it, you don't take it to the landfill. You take it back to the factory, melt it down again, re-spin it, re-dye it, and it goes back on the floor again someplace. And what this does is, one, it eliminates need for any raw material because you're using with the existing, working with the existing stock all the time, and nothing goes to the landfill. Now, I cite that as an initiative coming from industry that illustrates how we're going to have to restructure the economy to make it environmentally sustainable.
Brown's vision of our materials future goes beyond recycling, which he doesn't think can produce sustainability by itself. He has hopes for new technology, like electronic paper, which can be erased using an electronic signal. Theoretically, this could mean the same sheet of paper could be used over and over again, saving the wood pulp or fiber that newer recycled paper requires. Brown surveys a world economy influenced by forces that will bring about change. Some corporate executives, like the CEO of British Petroleum, are taking global warming seriously and taking steps to curb greenhouse emissions. Storm-related damage worldwide last year jumped to $98 billion, 48% greater than the previous high. This will have an impact on insurance premiums. The result, Brown thinks, will make everybody take global warming more seriously and provide economic incentives to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. During this century, huge amounts of effort and national treasure have gone into building armies and weapons for our national defense. Brown says in the next century, environmental considerations may play a much greater role in global security. The U.S. intelligence community is beginning to recognize that water shortages and crop failures may do more to destabilize developing countries than traditional political conflicts. Despite this, he sees the political landscape changing in ways that can improve the health of the planet.
We're beginning to see things happening that we haven't seen before. For example, the new coalition government that took over in Germany several months ago presented as one of its first initiatives a restructuring of the German tax system, essentially reducing taxes on income and wages and offsetting it with an increase of environmental taxes, particularly a tax on carbon emissions. And the interesting thing is they did not say we will do this if all the other industrial countries do it or if the rest of the world does it. They said we're doing it.
That was Lester Brown, president of the World Watch Institute, which publishes the annual State of the World Review. He was talking about his 1999 findings and the environmental outlook for the next millennium. The Environment Show is a national production. It's made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the William Bingham Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. www.hemmings.com. Contact us at The Environment Show and let us know how your environment is. It's green at wamc.org. That's green at wamc.org. Or Environment Show, 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. Economic and political chaos in Russia may spell the end for brown bears on that country's Pacific coast. One scientist studying the bears finds that not only is the population declining, but the fish, which are a critical food source, are being decimated. The Environment Show's Stephen Westcott has the story.
The Kamchatka Peninsula is a beautiful and rugged place with a wide range of vegetation and animal species. It's located north of Japan in the Russian Far East and extends into the Bering Sea. It possesses landscapes similar to Alaska. But despite its isolation, demand in the global economy and ineffective or non-existent controls are having a devastating impact on the area's wildlife. Brown bears are being particularly hard hit. 40 years ago, they numbered about 300,000. Today, biologists estimate their numbers at a maximum of 12,000, and poachers take much of the blame.
Different wildlife biologists there on the peninsula consistently gave us figures of around 2,000 bears per year were being illegally killed on the peninsula. And that's in addition to about 1,000 that were taken illegally, or were taken legally with license. So that's a harvest rate of about 3,000 per year and an estimated population of somewhere between 8 and 12,000. And clearly that's not sustainable.
That's William Laycock, research associate with Wildlife Conservation Society and a PhD student of wildlife biology at the University of Montana in Missoula. Bearskins can't provide hungry Russians with money, but William says sockeye salmon are also being caught by the thousands for human consumption. They spawn in waterways such as Lake Kurilsky and are a large part of the brown bear's diet.
This is a big spawning grounds for sockeye salmon, perhaps the largest or among the largest in all of the Pacific. There's approximately, on average, about 1.7 million sockeye come into this lake to spawn every year. That's on the average over the last 30 years. Last year, about 750 or 760,000 came in, well below 1.7 million.
Worse still, Laycock says only 460,000 salmon returned this year to spawn. He says uncontrolled salmon fishing in the ocean waters off the Kamchatka Peninsula and poaching are taking a toll. William says he saw fewer bears around Lake Kurilsky this year than in the past 2 years. He should know because for the past 4 years, Laycock has headed a research effort through Wildlife Conservation Society to study Kamchatka's brown bears. Accompanied by his wife and two young daughters, William tracks bears living in and around the Kamchatka Sanctuary, a 2,000-acre preserve that is supposed to be protected by Russian rangers. But Russia's economic crisis and disputes between governments over who is responsible for the sanctuary have left it unguarded. This makes Laycock's research even more important. He says there are two main objectives.
One of them is just to gather some basic baseline information on bears in Kamchatka in general, but more specifically in the South Kamchatka Preserve and the areas immediately to the north of it that aren't protected. And that includes population information, food, diet habits, etc. And then another aspect of it is looking at habitat relationships at a more or less a landscape level and movement patterns.
With the help of an Alaskan biologist and Russian colleague, William has collared 8 bears so far. They do this with the use of helicopters and tranquilizing darts. 4 bears received GPS Argo collars fitted around the animals' necks. GPS stands for Geographic Positioning System. Satellites pick up signals from the collars and give the exact location of the bears. The information is downloaded by a computer in Maryland and then passed on to the researcher. While Laycock is still in the process of gathering this information, he is noticing some trends.
One of the conventional wisdoms is that they'll just stay within the sanctuary, they'll be fine, they won't be prone to poaching or hunting outside of the sanctuary. Well, from the data that we gathered, both from the GPS collars and the VHF collars, we found that indeed the bears wander well beyond the boundaries of the sanctuary into 2 different hunting concessions outside of that border of this sanctuary.
Even though he is not on the peninsula year-round, William believes his presence alone is helping to scare off some poachers. He also believes his research is encouraging people in and out of Russia's borders to talk about brown bear populations.
So we've come to an agreement between Wildlife Conservation Society and the Sanctuary Administration that Wildlife Conservation Society will supply equipment, funds for equipment, boats, motors, fuel, etc., and that the administration will supply three wardens or rangers to be there full-time.
WCS has committed to support Laycock's research another year. What happens beyond that remains to be seen. What is even more uncertain is the economic and political climate in Russia. And until those elements are stabilized, brown bears may continue to face extinction on the Kamchatka Peninsula. For The Environment Show, I'm Stephen Westcott.
And now it's time for the Earth Calendar. As we speak, red and pink grapefruit are being picked in Florida. It's part of the Great American Harvest. Bill Mixon is president of Mixon Fruit Farms in Bradenton, Florida, located about 40 miles south of Tampa. His family has been growing fruit on 350 acres for the past 60 years. Wearing cotton gloves to protect the produce from damage, Bill says pickers gently place the grapefruit in tin boxes after they've been growing on the tree for about a year.
The picker harvests by hand and in a canvas bag, and he picks the fruit and then dumps it into these bins and fills them, and then those bins are brought into the packing house, and then we wash the fruit and grade it, and then it's ready for packing into the containers or whatever, whichever direction you want to go with them.
Small, scarred, or discolored grapefruit are used to make juice, while the better-looking produce is packed and shipped to market. Bill says more and more, grapefruit is being used for juicing and for pre-made fruit salads, both of which offer convenience to consumers. The whole process begins with the planting of grapefruit trees, which bear fruit after about a year. It will take 4 or 5 more years before the tree can reach large-scale production. Grapefruit farming is hard work and sometimes frustrating because of uncontrollable factors such as weather conditions that damage the crop.
In the fall of the year, when the fruit is getting heavy and more mature, sometimes you'll have these hurricanes that come close by, and you'll have wind damage and severe scarring, or even we have hailstorms every once in a while, and a hailstorm can do a tremendous amount of damage to fresh fruit crops because it leaves, where the ice hits the fruit, it leaves brown spots.
Grapefruit farmers are not totally at the mercy of environmental factors. Farmers irrigate during dry spells and spray the groves to prevent disease and deter insect damage. All the hard work pays off, though, not only in terms of providing a living for Bill's family, but providing a healthy and nutritious food source. Most interesting of all, perhaps, is the way Mixon enjoys eating red and pink grapefruit.
And then I like salt, a little bit of salt and a little bit of pepper on my grapefruit. And then I take a grapefruit spoon that has the serrated edges, and then you can just pluck the sections right out of the grapefruit, and the salt, of course, gives it a unique flavor, and it takes away some of the bitterness, especially in the early part of the year. Just a sprinkling of salt will make the grapefruit taste a lot sweeter, and of course, black pepper also gives it a flavor, and it's unique.
And for those who enjoy peeling and eating grapefruit, Bill Mixon says consumers should be looking for a fruit with a firm yet soft skin. And be extra nice to the fruits while visiting the produce section, because according to Bill, often the best tasting grapefruits are thin-skinned. And all of us who are thin-skinned are easier to get along with when treated nicely. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead, British Columbian forestry officials in Canada resent a move by some big corporations to stop using products made from old-growth trees. They say the company should clean up working conditions for their employees instead. We talk green about wilderness. Do we need to protect more of it? Some say we have enough already. And author Jerry Dennis takes us to a river where he hears sounds but can listen to nature. Stay with us. A few weeks ago, we reported on the Coastal Rainforest Coalition, which is comprised of environmental groups and more than 25 large multinational companies like IBM and Nike. Members of the coalition are vowing to phase out the use of paper and wood products that originate from old-growth timber stands in British Columbia. They hope market pressures will stop timber companies from logging in some of Canada's ancient forests. We recently heard what coalition members think about logging in British Columbia. Now, we hear from forestry officials who believe BC's forests are well managed and that some coalition members should first think about cleaning up their own houses. The Environment Show's Stephen Westcott has the story.
Timber industry officials don't deny they are cutting large, old trees in British Columbia. What they do deny is allegations made by environmentalists that many of the trees being harvested are 1,000 years old.
The reality is that isn't the age of our forests by a long shot. If we do have 1,000-year-old trees, they primarily occur at extremely high elevations in areas that we don't work in anyways. So I think that while there is a statement being made by these companies that they're concerned about environmental integrity, I would have to say that's a shared concern, and we've put together a really sophisticated policy and planning framework to recognize those values.
That's Larry Peterson, chief forester with British Columbia's Ministry of Forests, which owns mostly all of the forest areas in BC. The provincial government is also in charge of forest management, deciding where and how timber companies can harvest. And there are a lot of timberlands in BC, some 140 million acres, according to Peterson.
Our projections into the future are that we will be operating on less than one half of that land, so around 23 million hectares. I'm sorry, I've got to switch this over to acres for you. Around 56 million acres are what we project as our long-term forest operating land base. It's fair to say that very much of that forest land has what we call natural forest on it in a variety of age classes, and that also includes old-growth forest, so just less than half of that currently has old forest on it.
The definition of an old-growth forest varies depending on who you ask, but essentially it is an area that has never been cut before. Larry Peterson says the goal of the ministry is to have mixed forest classes. Many foresters would agree that having mixed aged classes helps maintain biodiversity. But others argue that scientists still don't fully understand how heavy cutting in old-growth areas affects wildlife. Given this, members of the coalition say they want the ministry and timber companies to stop logging in old-growth areas, especially in the coastal rainforests. But Larry Peterson says harvesting on old-growth areas in BC is unavoidable.
Simply because of the very natural extent of old forest on the landscape, we have not had a long enough harvesting history in the province to simply shift our industry at its current scale into stands which have been regenerated from the past.
Peterson says the province has plans to protect 12% of BC's 240 million acres in the form of parks. The ministry also has what is called the Forest Practices Code, which strictly outlines how harvesters can proceed. Peterson emphasizes that most areas are fully reforested with native tree species 1 to 3 years after logging has occurred, and says regeneration is generally not a problem in BC. Overall, he says, the ministry makes sure sensitive areas are protected, despite the claims of some environmentalists.
In fact, what we do is we plan very carefully for the maintenance of biological diversity on the working forest landscape by even maintaining a further level of protection in, for example, what we call riparian zones, or the areas where trees are in association with watercourses and lakes and so on. And those are very, very high-value ecological zones, and we maintain stand values or conservation values there.
Patrick Moore with Forest Alliance of BC agrees with Peterson and at the same time understands arguments by environmentalists and coalition members who oppose cutting in coastal old-growth areas of British Columbia. It's not surprising that Moore understands the environmentalist viewpoint because he used to be one. Moore is a former founder and director of Greenpeace who left the group in the mid-1980s. Now he is director of the Forest Alliance of BC, a group that represents the interests of timber companies. He says the timber industry isn't being given enough credit for making the changes it has in recent years and finds it odd that coalition members are focusing on the pulp and paper industry when most of the wood products exported out of BC are in the form of lumber. Additionally, Moore claims some members have even renounced their affiliation with the coalition.
Other companies, and three come to mind, is Nike, Levi Strauss, and Liz Claiborne, all of which are in the footwear and clothing business, are all facing boycotts of their own for labor practices in Southeast Asia in particular. And we think it's a little bit hypocritical for them to sign on to a boycott of BC forest products when they've got their own problems to look after, and maybe that's where they should be putting their emphasis. We are certainly putting our focus on dealing with the environmental issues and producing a forest industry that is up to speed and will pass muster with an independent verification of sustainable forestry practices, and that means certification, and we're moving into that now.
The timber industry is the single largest employer in British Columbia, providing $16 to $18 billion in exports to the province. Ministry of Forestry officials believe they are doing an effective job of managing the forests and providing residents with living wages. Meantime, members of the Coastal Rainforest Coalition wonder what species are living as a result of timber harvesting in BC's old growth areas. For The Environment Show, I'm Stephen Westcott.
We're Talking Green, and I'm Peter Burley. Over the years, substantial effort has been expended by environmental advocates, and substantial monies have been spent by public and private organizations to preserve wilderness lands. The theory has been that some places should be preserved in their natural state, undisturbed by human activity. Ray Harbin, whose paper, Whither Wilderness? How Much is Enough?, recently published by the Conservative Heartland Institute, thinks we don't need to protect anymore. He joins us from Georgia. Daryl Konefke is Vice President for Regulatory Conservation for the Wilderness Society, which is a national conservation group, and he takes, I'm sure, an opposite view. He's in Washington. So our topic today is wilderness and whether we need to protect more of it. Ray Harbin, let's start with you. You argue that protecting more wilderness lands is a bad idea. Why is
that? Actually, Peter, it's not quite accurate. We have to differentiate between wilderness with a capital W, i.e. federally designated, and wilderness with a small letter. I'm a life member of the Nature Conservancy, probably a member of more environmental groups than you are. What I'm against is when you look at the facts, what we have today, 105 million acres of federally designated wilderness, 30 million acres extracted from U.S. Forest Service multiple use lands. You're talking about an area, if you compare with all of England, all of Scotland, all of Portugal, and all of Greece, that group is smaller. It's a one-mile strip.
But what is your point? Is your point that you're opposed to wilderness with a capital W,
untouched, as opposed to
land in the public domain?
Well, no. I'm saying I'm for multiple use, I'm for timber usage, I'm for... I think we have enough. Someone asked me, by the way, a reporter from Boulder, Colorado, what plans my colleague and I had for taking wilderness out. I says, we have none. No one's even suggested that. We simply think we have enough. 105 million acres.
Okay, so again, just to sum up, your sense is that the stuff that's protected as wilderness with a capital W,
yes,
land that nothing should happen on, that people shouldn't be logging, they,
yes, that, we have enough.
We've got enough of that.
Yes.
Darrell, the Wilderness Society has argued for years that we need more of this. What is the rationale for that when Ray says we've got enough now?
The Wilderness Society has been an active advocate for wilderness, Peter, since the passage of the Wilderness Act itself in 1964 and beyond. In 1964, we created a national wilderness preservation system, made a sort of initial deposit into it of around 9 million acres, and that system has now grown to about 103 million acres. We think that we're about a third of the way where we ought to be. Wallace Stegner reminded us that we should save as much of it and of as many kinds as we can. The question of enough is a difficult one. We have all we're ever going to get, and my organization thinks we need to protect every acre that remains, and we need to protect it for a variety of reasons. Obviously, human recreation is one such. That is not the only reason. It's not even the most important reason for protecting wilderness. We think that one of the crucial services that wilderness provides is the opportunity to allow natural systems to operate naturally insofar as that's possible in a modern age, and so that our children will have the opportunity to enjoy those things as much as we have.
So,
you know, I agree with much of what you said, and I was, by the way, in 64, I was an avid supporter of wilderness in the beginning, and still am. I use it. I have a home in western North Carolina, which is bounded on one side of my land by wilderness, or adjacent to it. And I'm not against it. I simply think we have too much. Now, you stated something that I totally agree with, insofar as we can. And I think, my colleague and I think, and a great number of people, environmentalists that I've talked to in the past 10 years, we have gone as far as we can. The more we rely on science and positive management of systems, the less we have to rely on the random hazards and doubtful efficacy of, quote, nature, end quote.
Well, let me stop you right there. Are you telling us that, from your perspective, humans can manage ecosystems better than if they're left alone?
Yes, obviously.
And can you give us any example of that?
Well, you're familiar with what happened at Yellowstone. You're familiar with that. You're familiar what happened to the spruce fir forest in the southern Appalachians. In the 60s, when I was doing work up there, the Forest Service later, because they had a lot of pictures, they wanted to trade some of the pre-pathogen forest pictures that I had for some stuff that they were developing there at some scientific stuff they were developing at the park. You see, I was in on the ground floor when people were saying, hey, we can do something about these insects now. No, they waited 30 years till it was too damn late, thinking, oh, no, this is a wilderness thing.
Let's hear Darrell on that subject. The proposition has been put forward that humans can manage ecosystems better than they can manage themselves. Do you agree with that?
I think that speaks of a certain arrogance, Peter. I think every place we've meddled, we found to our dismay that we were wrong or inadequate, that our childlike faith in science was ill-placed. What happened in Yellowstone is a result of a very long period of decades, in fact, of fire suppression. I think the thinking in the conservation community and certainly in the Forest Service has moved way beyond that, and the Park Service as well. We are now to the point where we are all saying the same thing, and that is that fire is a natural part of the ecosystem. We've got to return it where it makes sense, and when we can do that without threatening human safety and human property. And we can do that in an awful lot of places, and we're doing more of it all the time.
Ray, the world has gone on for quite some time with places that were not actively managed, and a lot of those places seem to be in pretty good shape. You think people could do better?
We're not at 1650. We no longer have a billion acres of teeming forest land for experimentation. The year is 1999, not 1650. We must manage our systems for 21st century conditions using 21st century knowledge and science.
Well, let me ask you something about that. Isn't there a difference between managing some of the system, much as you run a farm?
Yes.
Grow trees on a farm,
yes,
for harvest. Isn't that quite different than,
yes,
saying there ought to be some places that manage themselves both because you may protect some biological diversity that you don't even know about, or because human beings ought to be able to find places that haven't been managed.
Peter, you're exactly right. I could not agree more, and we have set aside in this country in the past 40 years, 30 years, 103, I was corrected there, 103, well, I'd say 104 million acres. And we've dedicated that to seeing what nature does over time. I think that's all we can really afford with all the conditions, all the things that we're facing, not the least of which is this global warming thing. Many of my colleagues don't believe in it. But if you saw the article in Journal Science in October dealing with the amount of carbon that the eastern deciduous forest was ostensibly sequestering, how can we possibly set aside more? Because we know that all wilderness systems, at least eastern deciduous, at 75, 80 years, they're in stasis. They no longer pull carbon down. If in fact, global warming is an issue with a moral equivalence of war, we need to get busy.
Darrell, what about the argument that 103 million is enough?
It is not enough, and it's not enough for at least one very clear reason, Peter, and that is the fact that the system as it stands today is comprised largely of those consensus areas of scenic grandeur. So we have done a pretty fair job in this country of protecting the spectacular. We have ignored on a wholesale basis the truly important, and that's other systems which don't look like the High Rockies, for an example. And I very specifically mean the desert and canyon lands of a place like Utah or Nevada or the western part of Oregon or western Colorado. These places are every bit as critical to the web of life that uses them and which they sustain as our high mountain areas. We've done a very poor job of protecting them, and that gets us back to the variety in the National Wilderness Preservation System, and there isn't very much of it.
Let's ask you about that, Ray. You've been talking about trees before. Darrell is saying that there are desert areas and other ecosystems that need to be protected. He's mentioned parts of Utah in specific. Do you object to naming those as wilderness areas and putting those in the public domain?
I probably would not. There's some friends of mine who would, but I'm concerned about global warming, has been since it was first offered as a scientific scenario.
So why does protecting tree areas not help the global warming situation?
Well, if you saw the article in Science, in the series of articles that have been feeders from it, you will note that it was the working forest that was sequestering the forest. And it was my God, people have known that for 15 years. And it was attempted, several articles in Nature, several articles in Science that dealt with that. But this was the first one that was truly, or at least on some extent.
So you're arguing that a managed forest managed to capture more CO2 than a more natural forest. Is that the point?
Well, yeah, there's no question about that. Because
Darrell, do you believe there's no question about that?
About global warming?
Yes.
I don't see how any sensible human being can doubt it.
Can doubt what?
No, but the question was, the point that Ray is making is that the managed forest is more effective at dealing with global warming problems than the forest that is in a wilderness state.
And I'm not a scientist, but it doesn't make a great deal of sense to me to think that we can do a better job than nature left essentially alone can do.
Well, now listen a minute, Darrell. Think about this. You must be close to 40. Peter, I've seen you on TV. You're probably 52.
I'm 61.
Well, I'm 60. And listen, we should have died 12 years ago, you and I, because apart from the medicine, we've seen the 20th century. We had a lifespan of about 48 years. And forests are the same way. The whole system is the same way.
Ray, you're losing me. It seems to me the forest is going to do better if people aren't cutting down the trees.
The reason we aren't dead is because science has given us a longer lifespan. The reason managed systems sequester carbon is because the carbon is removed in the form of biomass and taken to places where it is sequestered outside the system. If you see what I'm saying, and then the forest is allowed to regrow. Let me give you an example. A high-density subdivision, and God knows there's nobody who has fought rampant urbanism to the degree that I have. I'm chapter head of one of the biggest anti-growth areas here in the city, but we got to face the facts. A high-density subdivision, I'll define that as 2 2,600-foot homes per acre. Even if brick veneered, will sequester 50,000 pounds of carbon for the life of the average family. Now listen, less than 10% of the eastern hardwood forest possesses this density.
Okay.
It's a matter of concentrating it at a point, taking it, and then the acre that you cut, it sinks the carbon and replaces that which you removed and sequestered in this home, or these two homes.
Okay. I want to thank you both. We've been discussing wilderness lands and whether they need to be protected, whether we have too much wilderness already, or whether we should protect any more. My guests have been Ray Harbin. He's co-author of the Heartland Institute study, Whither Wilderness and How Much is Enough? And Daryl Knuppe. He is vice president of the Wilderness Society, and we'd like to hear your views on this subject. Give us a call. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. We've been talking green, and I'm Peter Burley. You can listen to The Environment Show anytime on your personal computer. Go to our website. It's www.enn.com/envshow. That's www.enn.com/envshow. We all have places that are special to us. For some, it's a city street. For others, it's deep in the wilderness. For author Jerry Dennis, it's a river in northern Michigan where the sound of a paddle is just part of a symphony of sounds. In this portrait of place, Dennis reads from his book titled The River Home, An Angler's Exploration.
Aside from my old buddy Craig Date, who while he's canoeing likes to sing a rousing rendition of Love is a Many Splendored Thing, most of my friends prefer being quiet when they're outdoors. It's a virtue I embrace, in theory at least. I've learned that when I refrain from talking, banging gunwales, snapping branches, and howling at the sky, I become more aware of my surroundings and am more likely to still the senseless inner chatter that fills my head most of the time. Usually when we say we want peace and quiet, we don't mean peace and silence. We want the absence of noise, not the absence of sound. Seeking relief from television blare and traffic roar, we turn to quiet music, the rustle of wind and trees, bird song, and, most soothing of all, water. Nothing puts us at ease so quickly as rain on a roof, the rumble of ocean surf, and the whispering of a river. When we surround ourselves with such sounds, it doesn't take long to start hearing the music out there. Being quiet is such a natural ancillary to being on the water that by the time we start sagging and graying, it's often become automatic. Kids don't get it, which is why fathers insist so loudly on silence and have so little patience with infractions. I consider it a minor victory every time I convince a child to get quiet enough to notice bird calls and frog racket. It was a big moment when my son Nick, at age 6, spoke up after a silence to announce that a mourning dove sounds exactly like somebody blowing gently over the top of a Coke bottle. You have to open yourself to natural spectacle, but willing it to happen is as difficult as willing yourself to fall in love. Like a child, you have to be empty of expectation, have to possess eyes that see and ears that hear. It takes practice, like anything. Sometimes you can be surprised. One afternoon during a leisurely canoe trip down the Boardman River, near my home in northern Michigan, I shut my eyes for a relief from the sun and became aware of a complex background of sounds I had missed until then. Such moments sometimes make me crazed with alertness. I want to listen with every cell of my skin, see with my palms, taste with my nipples and toes. I don't want to miss anything, and so, of course, blinded by a kind of sensory frenzy, I miss almost everything. But that afternoon, I listened to the canoe slip through the water with a sound like silk being torn, accompanied by a great deal of quiet hissing, humming, and chuckling. The river itself was a symphony of slurs and murmurs, distant throbbing and much hushed gurgling, gulping, and grumbling. I dipped my paddle into the water and it started a separate melody line, a rhythmic sip and swallow, followed by the swishing draw of the blade being pulled and a rhythmic dripping when I lifted it. I don't believe that every encounter with nature automatically transports us back to some mystical sense of well-being stolen away by modern life. No doubt people have been inattentive and distracted as long as we've had the brains to string thoughts together. But I know that we're equipped to see and hear more than we usually do, and that sometimes, when conditions are right, we can open ourselves to a world so rich with sensations that it makes the booming progress of civilization dim to insignificance. Drifting downstream that afternoon, I realized that there's a big difference between hearing and listening. Hearing is passive, listening is active. We hear traffic and airport noise and the shouting loudspeakers in a department store. We listen to laughing children and hooting doves, to leaves rustling in wind-stirred aspens, to trout sipping mayflies in a river. In these noisy times, the thousand subtle voices of a river can throw a calm over our lives. I swear it's music to our ears.
That was Jerry Dennis reading from his book, The River Home, An Angler's Explorations. It's published by St. Martin's Press. Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. Do Russian bears eat grapefruit? The Navy is studying the Endangered Species Act to find out. Order a copy of the program to learn the answer. Call 1-800-323-9262 and ask for show number 475. The Environment Show is a national production which is solely responsible for its content. Alan Shartok is executive producer, Stephen Westcott is producer, and Ray Graff is audio engineer. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the William Bingham Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby, www.hemmings.com. Be good to the Earth, and join us next week for the Environment Show.